The views and opinions expressed on TalkBack are not those of the staff, management, or advertisers.
Whew, it's always a pleasure to get through those sponsors. It's so nice to have so many people that want to listen to the show and so many sponsors that want to support it. One of the things it's also nice to listen to is our buddy Bob Seidenschwartz, who's helping me out this week, filling us in with some extra World Affairs Council show. And he's brought us another great one today. We've got Gabriel Scheinman, a friend of the show who's been on before from the Jewish Policy Center. He's the director of the Jewish Policy Center. And I'm sure we're going to be talking a little bit about a concern to many Jewish people, including Chuck Schumer, the Iran deal.
Yeah.
And so, Bob, you want to go ahead and get things started?
Well, let's welcome Gabe Scheinman from Washington, D.C. to Missoula, Montana. And I was filling him in a little bit that we're getting our power back on, and this is only one of two radio stations that's functioning right now. So, Gabe, welcome to Missoula. Thank you for taking time out of your day.
Thanks for having me.
So Gabe, tell us what's going on in your neck of the woods. Are things heating up when it comes to this deal? It seems like after the announcement by Schumer, there's been a lot of backlash against that. Well, other people are saying that it's maybe just a sign that they're locked, that it's a done deal. Well, what's your take on it?
I mean, August in Washington is usually fairly quiet. I mean, Congress skipped town last week. The president is in Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts, but this August is pretty busy because, as you can imagine, the vote in Congress on the Iran deal is coming up in about a month or 5 weeks. And so both sides are furiously lobbying, furiously counting votes to see exactly where they end up. So as you mentioned, at the end of last week, Senator Chuck Schumer became the only Democrat in the Senate so far to actually come out against the deal and say he was going to vote against. And that has caused a lot of consternation in the White House, who have sort of attacked them both for not thinking of the best interests of the United States and sort of leveling some dual loyalty accusations against them, and also for some of the harder left liberal media for attacking him for being a warmonger. And yet even the White House press spokesperson come out and say that Schumer might not be eligible to be the next Democratic leader in the Senate because of his opposition to the president. So there's a big war of words going on here.
It's a bit of a direct threat right there from the spokesperson. Which spokesperson was it?
It was Josh Earnest, the White House press person. He got asked, you know, Schumer is sort of long expected to take up the reins from Harry Reid after Harry Reid retires at the end of next year, and sort of asked the question, what impact does this have on that potential vote? And he sort of came out and said, well, you know, this might be able to affect it, or we'll see. Have to see what people think about it after the fact. And you have some of the president's former advisors now working in various places in the private sector basically take to the media to basically condemn Schumer and saying that, you know, he'd be such a weak leader because of his defiance of the president on this vote. So
I love
it
the
spillover into, you know, partisan politics as well.
I love the rear view nature of what appears to be the new Democratic practice of dealing with things after the fact. We'll read the bill after we find out what's in it. We'll go ahead and find out how this Iran deal plays out after it's enacted, and we'll find out what happens to Chuck Schumer after we find out what the polls say. Bob, you had something to say.
Yeah, just I wanted to point out with Schumer that, you know, this is politics at its best or at its worst. Schumer, it could be said, that was a safe vote.
You mean Schumer?
Schumer's vote was safe. He knew that let's just say hypothetically,
right,
that he knew that this was going to get approval, it was going to pass. So he's got a constituency. He still has to answer to New York, heavy Jewish population. He's Jewish himself. So, Gabe, was this a case where the calculation of coming out against, of course, has repercussions, but also from a political standpoint, to my point about his vote being a safe vote?
I mean, that's entirely possible. I mean, I guess we won't really know until there's the vote. But, for example, it came out today that although he will vote against the deal and his spokesperson said that he would vote to override a presidential veto, but he would not whip the vote with his colleagues. So he would not call around and sort of try and convince his colleagues to vote with him.
Okay.
So it's kind of trying to thread the needle a little bit in that sense, saying, well, you know, I'm going to stand my ground on what I believe for a variety of reasons, but maybe in the best of worlds, it's best that I am not blamed for, you know, being the downfall of the president however cataclysmic effect they think it might have.
And there are other Jewish senators, congressmen that are voting with the president. So it's not an exclusive club here that just because you're Jewish, you're voting against this particular act?
Not at all. I mean, I think I forget the exact count. I think there's 35 or 37 Jewish members of Congress combined in the House and the Senate, and they've fallen on both sides of the deal so far,
right,
coming out in support, coming out against, and being undeclared. And also to mention, it's not so much necessarily Schumer himself, but usually we think of kind of constituencies, electoral constituencies. His colleague, his fellow senator from New York, Kirsten Gillibrand, came out in support of the deal.
Right.
So one of the differentiations with Schumer is that Schumer has been on the record, both, you know, on video for a number of years, in terms of especially the last few months, over what were the necessary components in this deal that would require it to be a good deal. And when he came out against, he basically went back through them and said, none of these things have been met.
All right, we got to go to a break. I have to ask you a question. I'm not Jewish. Bob, I believe you have a Jewish ancestry. I assume our caller, Gabriel Scheinman, does. But one of the questions...
Good educated guest.
Yeah, good educated guest. One of the things I wanted to ask you is that, you know, left-wing groups, people that would normally be full-on supporting the president, groups like Tablet Online, have accused the organization, the government itself, in this case the Obama administration, of using kind of racial-tinged language in opposing the people that are opposing this deal and in highlighting it on Mr. Schumer in particular. They have a headline up right now called Crossing a Line to Sell a Deal the White House and Its Allies Shouldn't Need to Smear American Jews and a Sitting Senator as Dual Loyalists to Make Their Case. This is by the editors of that publishing house. I was hoping we could get some comments on that after the break. I haven't personally picked up on any of the racially tinged language, but maybe you have. I'm sure you're more sensitive to that sort of thing than I am. We'll be back to after the break. We'll get some comments on that, and we'll, of course, take your calls. We're going to open the lines up over the break. If you want to call on the Iran deal or anything from Gabriel Scheinman from the Jewish Policy Center, now's your chance. The phone number is 721-1290. A lot of people think that the Obama administration has stepped into the danger zone when it comes to racially charged statements about the Iran deal and opposition to those that are opposing the Iran deal. And I just wanted to hear from you, Bob, and from you, Gabriel, if this is something you picked up on as well, or if the Tablet is out of line when they accuse the American government right now of smearing American Jews.
Please let our guests address that.
Sure. I mean, I agree with the Tablet editorial that you mentioned. I mean, unfortunately, it's mostly coming from the president, less so from the Secretary of State. But the president has basically set out the debate on the deal in very stark terms, which is either you're for this deal or you're for war. Oh, and by the way, the same people that are against this deal were the ones that supported the Iraq War. Oh, and by the way, they have a lot of lobbyists and are spending a lot of money. Oh, and by the way, the only reason I could possibly understand if someone is against this deal is if they feel for Israel. And so by basically setting up the terms of the debate such that you cannot rationally oppose this deal based on American interests, American national security interests, but the president is basically saying that your opposition to this deal must either come because you're beholden to lobbyists and beholden to money, which is often anti-Semitic canard that's thrown out there, or because you're beholden to Israel, which is a more explicit anti-Semitic canard that comes out there. And it really ignores, I mean, if you look at the polling on this deal, I mean, Americans overall are against it. There's a poll yesterday that polled the different boroughs in New York, and the borough that had the largest Jewish population was the only one that was for the deal. I mean, Staten Island and Queens were some of the ones that were the most against. So it's really the president is playing very, very dirty politics.
Well, and Gabe, I see parallels with the race debate in this country in terms of how the discussion is presented, how the prototype is delivered for purposes of moving forward certain views or certain agendas. So, you know, the game plan here is not unlike many other things that have happened on many other different issues, quite frankly.
So are you saying Israeli lives matter too?
Well, Israeli lives matter. Yeah. I mean, it's just there's a methodology here that's involved.
Watch out,
and it's also twisted the debate. I mean, it's an important geopolitical question, and it is entirely possible to oppose this deal purely based on what one thinks are the interests of the United States. But the president has twisted and framed the debate in such a way that forcing people to come out against the deal because they're worried about the impact it has on Israel rather than the impact that it has on the United States. I mean, it's the United States that's the preeminent power in the Persian Gulf. It'll be the United States that's most affected by whether this deal goes through or what happens to it. It's not necessarily Israel, and it's not the American Jewish community.
You know, this is actually one of the things that has stuck out to me about this particular president. Usually I don't step aside to take a jab at the president directly. I'll criticize a policy or something here or there. But this is one thing that I really do have a problem with, any politician that does it. It's when you cannot see your opponent as having a rational point of view or as approaching the topic from a viewpoint of earnest wanting to do good for the public. And I actually give President Obama the credit. I think he does think this is the best thing, or at least think he's trying to do good during his presidency. Well, but I disagree with him intellectually. But I just don't feel that when he talks about me clinging to my guns and my religion, that he has the same respect for me.
Beyond that, also, it's I don't know if you remember the a couple of years ago, almost 10 years ago, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer wrote a book called The Israel Lobby, based on an article. And there's two political scientists, and their argument basically was that they opposed the Iraq War. And they say that there was no rational reason in any way one could come to the conclusion that the Iraq War was a good thing. Therefore, someone's mind must have gotten perverted by a lobby. Someone must have gone outside the normal processes for reaching a decision, and it must have been some sort of special interest. And that's how they come to blame the Israel lobby for the Iraq War and a bunch of other ills in American foreign policy. And the president, although obviously not explicitly saying the same thing, is coming up very close, saying you cannot oppose this deal based on American national interest. It must be something else at play.
We got a phone call on the line I want to take first. Oh, we just lost Mike. Sorry, it took too long to get there.
John, I want to come
Mike,
back.
Give us a call back.
I want to come back to this point that we're on. There's, my experience has been that there is a strong belief amongst a lot of people, both those who are educated and not, that the Jewish lobby is a powerful influence in this country. Now, whether there's truth to that, I'm sure there's always some degree of a little bit of truth in urban legend, but from the standpoint of Israel, Gabe, we had the Israeli Council General here in Missoula just last week, Council General David. Can you please give, because he, and I think he gave a very reasoned overview of Israel's concerns. Hmm. We have to take a call, but
can we get Mike's call, and I don't want to make him wait.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's all right.
Oh, we lost Gabriel Scheinman.
John,
awesome. I am just messing up here.
You're fired,
I should be.
You just been elevated.
Mike, go ahead and ask your question for us. Oh, well, you know what? I'm going to take an early break here since I've dumped my lines on accident. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We've got Bob Seidenschwartz in studio, and he had a question before we left. And Mike had a question, too. Sorry you got dumped twice, Mike. Give us a call back, 721-1290, and, or anyone else for that matter. We're taking anyone's calls. We're speaking with Gabriel Scheinman from the Jewish Policy Center. We have about 4 minutes left in this break. So, Bob, go ahead.
Gabe, could you please elaborate a little bit on your comment you made about the U.S. having a lot more at risk here than even possibly Israel? Give us some detail.
Sure. I mean, obviously the Iranian regime has, you know, repeatedly, it's part of its ethos that talking about wiping Israel off the map. So, of course, let's not discount that. But if you think about where, you know, the United States is, I mean, the Persian Gulf is an American lake. I mean, our Navy, our Air Force operates out of there. We've been there for over 30 years. And so in terms of, you know, our forces that are directly at risk, and it's not about this deal from Iran in general, it's American forces, not Israeli forces. It's American forces that are now back in Iraq. I mean, we have 35 or 4,000 soldiers on the ground in Iraq dealing with ISIS, often sharing the same facilities as Iranian-backed Shiite militias. And in fact, the president is even at times said one of the reasons we need this deal is because without this deal that, you know, Iran might order these Shiite militias to turn on U.S. soldiers and that we'd have to be looking over our back. It's almost sort of saying, well, the other guy has more leverage on us than we think. And these are the same militias, by the way, that, you know, responsible for the deaths of over 500 American servicemen over the course of the Iraq War. So, it's the United States that is most concerned about the free flow of oil from the Persian Gulf, not Israel. It's the United States that has the most assets in the region, in that immediate region, than Israel does. And it's the United States that has come under withering attack from Iran before. I mean, after Al-Qaeda, Iran and Iran-backed terrorism is the greatest killer of Americans over the last 35 years. So it's not something that we should or should not be doing simply because of, you know, Israeli concerns or other Gulf state concerns. I mean, Iran is a direct threat to American security as well.
All right, we got our caller, Mike, back on the line. So we're going to do this and hope it works here. All right, Mike, can you hear us?
I can, actually.
All right, perfect. Thanks for calling back and being patient with us. What's your question? What's your question for Gabriel?
Well, we're talking about Chuck Schumer and about the Congress voting on this, and from what I understand, it's all more kabuki theater. That the administration has gotten this deal approved at the UN Security Council. Russia, China, and the Europeans are already lifting their sanctions. Basically, the deal a few years down the road gives them the right to develop intercontinental ballistic missiles. They're already sending their top guy to Moscow to go shopping for such things. Is there actually any way at this point we can put the genie back in the bottle?
Good question, Gabriel.
It's a really good question, and I wish I had a simple answer, but the true answer is yes and no. So on the one hand, a congressional vote of disapproval and obviously overriding the president's veto should keep the two major legislative sanctions that Congress passed that are against Iran's oil sector and Iran's banking and financial sector in place. And that, as a consequence, should keep all companies, both American and European companies, from actually doing real business in Iran, because the major business to be done needs to be done through the financial and through the energy sector. So technically, that's in place. However, there's so many other ways to vitiate sanctions, both through the president's executive orders, through the president's just frank non-enforcement of American law. I mean, this president has a history of not enforcing American law, whether it comes to immigration, whether it comes to health care, whether it comes to climate change things, whether it comes to the Defense of Marriage Act. The president can just not enforce it, and Congress might have to take the president to the Supreme Court because of it. And lastly, the way sanctions really work is not just the specific legal mechanisms that prevent companies from doing business or try to punish companies if they do business, but it's the atmosphere, the psychology of sanctions that surround an economy. So a lot of companies might still go to do business in Iran because they know that at least there won't be additional sanctions coming, and the sanctions that might occur as is would take years to have effect. So it's kind of difficult to tell what the real answer to that would be.
All right, Mike, you got a follow-up question? We got about a minute left.
I guess the follow-up would be, say we have an incoming Republican president in January 2017, and he wants to undo this. I would suggest that the best way to slap sanctions back on would be a declaration by the United States that you can either do business with Iran or you can do business with the United States, but you can't do business with both. I think that might put a little bit of a crimp on China and Russia, and I'm wondering what you would think of that.
Real quick, Gabriel. Thanks for your call, Mike.
And the president, it would certainly be within the power of the next president to do that, because Obama is only suspending the application of current sanctions. It's not new or different law.
All right, so we're out of time for the segment. Thanks, Gabriel. We'll be back right after this break.
This is Talk Back with Peter Christian and John King. 721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309.
This is News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and now 101.5 FM.
News Talk KGVO,
Missoula's news and weather station.
Talk Back is brought to you by Herbert & Gerbert Sandwich Shop, open on Higgins Avenue next to the Big Dipper. Also, Kootenai Creek Village, the maintenance-free active adult community in Stevensville. Dig It Excavating, bringing 30 years of excellence to every job. NC Design Studio, specializing in high-end residential architecture and commercial development. And online at ncdesignstudio.com. And also, The Mustard Seed.
The views and opinions expressed on TalkBack are not those of the staff, management, or advertisers.
All right, we're back on the TalkBack show. This hour, we're going to be speaking with Gabriel Scheinman. He's the director of the Jewish Policy Center out of Washington, D.C. We've been talking about the Iran deal and the way that's impacting both relations between the president's cabinet, himself, and the spokesman for the president, and American Jews. Also, the way that this deal might impact both the United States and Israel. And I know Bob, during the top of the break, was really interested in finding out more about this whole idea of sanctions, whether or not it would be possible to reimpose them if they were ever taken away. And you're pretty skeptical about it, right? The idea of a snap-back sort of sanctions is unlikely.
Not only, I think, is it unlikely, but we were having a great conversation during the break, and I want Gabe to kind of start and elaborate on that in terms of what the economics are, because there are American companies, even prior to this, that were doing business with Iran. And there's many different ways to do business, even if it's not direct. So this is one of the basic premises of the president, that economic opportunity, opening up the society, will change Iranian politics. So, Gabe, let's kind of pick up on that conversation we were having during the break about what these sanctions are and some of the issues here.
The idea that the major sanctions that had the most, I mean, the United States has basically imposed some sort of sanctions since the Islamic Revolution and the takeover of the embassy. But it was really in 2010 and then in 2012 where we imposed major sanctions targeting their energy market and their banking and financial sector. And the sanctions basically prevented any company, and you designate entities or companies, you don't designate countries, but prevented or deterred companies from doing business in Iran if they wanted to do business in the United States as well. And you see, once those were imposed, very quickly the Iranian economy started to crater. And that's what, you know, people say brought the country to the table. The problem in the deal, and these are the sanctions that the White House, that the president wants to suspend as part of the deal. But the problem with the deal is that it is the threat of the reimposition of these sanctions that is supposed to keep Iran in compliance with the deal. The way the deal is written is not only if we were to snap back these sanctions, does that give Iran a right to leave the deal, but when you snap back these sanctions, all previous deals, investments, transfers, things like that, are grandfathered in. So in the next couple of years, you might very well see a rush of Chinese, Russian, European, maybe even American businesses and companies rushing into Iran, signing deals. And then if there is a violation, and if we do snap back, all those deals are grandfathered in, and so they don't apply. So there will be a very quick rush to do business inside of Iran.
Well, let me ask you this, because we spoke with an expert on this sort of thing the other day. Right. We had our guest in, Mr. College, right?
Yeah, John College.
And and he used to be one that he would watch, make sure sanctions were going okay in Iran back in the 90s. And he said he already knows of American corporations that are pushing for this deal and are bringing papers to the table, basically, for an expected Iranian deal. And the same thing is going on in England. Same thing is going on in France and Germany. The same thing has been going on in Russia and China. If they haven't been trading already, they want to expand their trade with Iran. So I guess my question for you, is this just a conspiracy by multinational corporations that want money over possible detrimental effects of Iran having a nuclear bomb and an ICBM?
And John, Gabe, I just want to John College made the point, too, that it's not just enough to have these in place. You've got to have the entities, the agencies, capable of enforcing these sanctions on companies that potentially are doing business and actually being prohibitive if they are caught doing so. So what is the potential that we're going to be able to even, you know, enforce the sanctions on the very companies that are doing business there?
I mean, look, as usual, where you stand depends on where you sit. And if you're a company, your number one goal is to make money and to do business. And anything that gets in the way of that is bad. So, of course, American companies, European companies, I mean, any company is going to want a safe and stable and non-punitive regulatory environment to be able to do business, whether in Iran or in Burma or in Cuba or any of these countries. That's a given. But at the same time, for the most part, these companies have a far greater share of investments and of interest in the American market. And if having to choose between the, what is it, $15 trillion American economy and the, you know, $800 billion or $1 trillion Iranian economy, the choice is going to be pretty obvious. So that's a set no matter how they cut it, and I think that's something that's going to take a long time to get out of their head. The question is, will we actually enforce what we say we enforce, as Bob asks? And it's an open question, and that depends on political will. This president has not enforced many, many American laws because he disagrees with them, whether on health care, immigration at the time, the Defense of Marriage Act. They just said, we don't agree with it, therefore we won't enforce it. Drug laws. There is a concern that the president might, you know, see a violation, or if the deal doesn't go through, that Iran doesn't get the sanctions relief from Congress that he thinks he wants, but just not enforce the law, and that's a big problem.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about the Iran deal and the businesses involved, I mean, it's something Bob was kind of alluding to earlier. There's this libertarian view of trade, which I actually share, which is that trade helps make better neighbors. It develops a sense of mutual self-interest that you've got this thing to cling to besides your animosity against the person that you used to have arms up against, because you have a business interest that helps you and your family and maybe your local community, and you have this thing that used to be your enemy that's trading with you. It kind of helps mend some of those fences. Is there any hope out of the Jewish Policy Center that these increased trade deals will facilitate more love for the countries outside of Iran and better borders between Iran and its neighbors?
And is that historically true in terms of conceptually having trade relations keeping countries from going to war, or is that not the case, Gabe?
I mean, it's a popular political science argument, and there's some evidence for it, but there's also evidence against it. If you look back to prior to World War I, Great Britain and Germany were each other's largest trading partner. That certainly didn't prevent an arms race and then war. If you look at today, the United States and China are major, major trading partners. And, of course, we haven't gone to war, but I can't exactly say that the situation is intense. You look at issues between Japan and China, same thing. I mean, China is the number one trade partner of almost every single country in East and Southeast Asia, and yet there are skirmishes in the South China Sea between China and a lot of these other countries. So it's kind of unclear whether that exactly works out so easily in that way. Is there a possibility that if the deal goes through, if Iran abides by the deal, if the Iran returns to international markets, that the people become richer, that they will have less support for the regime? It's possible. But at the end of the day, it's the regime that has the guns. And a few years ago, if you remember, it's the regime that put down a popular revolt.
Well, I'm not a big fan of the president. But as I said earlier, I do like to see any political opponent, or someone that disagrees with me politically, doesn't necessarily have to disagree with me for evil reasons. I think that a lot of people have good intentions. This is the way that I have kind of justified this move by this administration in the best possible light. I want to see if you think that there's any holes in it or whether or not you think it's accurate. And basically it's this: the United States is pushed into the current deal. It is the best deal possible because whether we want to or not, if we don't sign this deal, these other countries, China, Russia, Germany, France, the UK, are going to go ahead and start trading anyway. And the sanctions, the power, the teeth in the sanctions are going to be out. And right now, because we are working together and these countries do want to look good in the rest of the world's eyes, they're going to put on a little bit more prohibitions, a little bit more testing, a little bit more scrutiny than they would on their own because we're forcing this deal. And because this is our last chance, because they're going to go ahead and do it anyway, this is the best deal that we're going to get. Even though there's problems with it, even though it's not what we wanted, even when they put out the framework a few months ago, there's new stuff on top of that. Even though it's not the most ideal thing, it's the most practical thing. And President Obama is pushing for it because he knows that if we don't get this deal signed, there will be nothing in place to help prevent a rush to a nuclear arms race in the Middle East from Iran and its neighbors. And this is what he's doing to try to help save the world. So, what's your take?
The issue with the president's position is that it's non-falsifiable. There's no way that we can prove that there would be a better deal on hand. All we can say is that, well, had you done X, Y, or Z, we think you'd be in a stronger negotiating position. And that's what I think is actually true. You know, if you look at the president's basically saying that, well, we had to, as you said, we had to make a deal because the sanctions were crumbling. There's no evidence of that. And the Iranian economy was cratering in when these negotiations started in 2012, but even in 2013 when we went public with them.
Now, real quick, isn't there evidence of trade already between Russia and China? That would be signs that the sanctions are crumbling.
But there's always been trade, and the sanctions, you sanction companies or entities, not countries. So it really depends on those individual companies or entities. Because, Russian energy companies, for example, don't do a lot of trade in the United States. And so as a consequence, they don't lose anything by not having access to the American market. The same is with Chinese entities and big corporations, for that matter. So it really depends on entity by entity. But again, most of these companies, they don't, you know, keep to the sanctions or enforce the sanctions because of their own goodwill. They keep so because not doing so would be in violation of American law and, you know, begin real punishments against them. So as long as those American sanctions remain in place, and there's no reason why they wouldn't, there's no reason to expect why these other companies would not continue to comply with them. So the argument doesn't really hold up there.
All right. We'll get back into it in just a second. I'm a little late for my break. Give us a call. I have one line open. 721-1290 is the number. Once again, that number is 721-1290.
Rafting season is here, and we're ready at Outdoor Supply and Rental. Kelly here. The rivers are calling, and we have what you need. We're Montana's premier rafting store with all the brands with the best prices on rafts, oars, PFDs, and accessories. Rafting's a big part of our lives, and we make it a priority to give you the best advice and prices possible. And don't forget, this is a great time of year for us to take care of your raft repair problems. Whether you do it yourself or ask us, we're your best source for anything rafting. Outdoor Supply and Rental in Tremper's, your locally owned guide to the great outdoors.
Get your calls in at 721-1290. Now, Bobby, I know you were positing some questions on the break there. Go ahead.
Gabe, you made a comment that we played a strong hand weakly in these negotiations. Would you please elaborate on that? Because I think it's kind of interesting to the audience to hear this.
Our economy is 15 times the size of the Iranian economy. Every single Persian Gulf country is allied with us. Our defense spending is, you know, triple or quadruple what the Iranians have. And we have modern weapons. They have, in fact, a lot, they're still using American weapons we gave them during the Shah, I mean, two score years ago. We had enacted sanctions that the entire world supported that had sent their economy, an oil-rich economy, into double-digit recessions for two consecutive years. And instead, what the president is arguing, saying, well, we signed this deal because the sanctions were crumbling. There's no evidence of that. We had to sign this deal because our partners were going to abandon us. There's no evidence of that. And we had to sign this deal because without it, that Iranian threats to American personnel, whether in Iraq or in the Persian Gulf, would have gone up. And again, there's no evidence of that. So we went to the negotiations with a very strong hand, and we came out of it with a very weak deal. What? The president had, you know, if the president's, you know, the Democratic Party supported by the labor unions would have rejected such poor negotiation tactics. This is not how you negotiate if you want a good deal.
Well, let me ask you this, Gabriel. If you don't agree with my best case scenario for the president, and I know asking questions of intention are always landmine questions you get in trouble for, but that's why I like to ask them. So let me ask you this. What do you think is the intention behind this deal? Why is the president so fierce in supporting this deal? And I understand why countries would be, because of their economic self-interest, but why do you think particularly our country is?
I think the president is a big believer, and this is, you know, you got to be careful without going into too much psychoanalysis, but the president is a big believer that all problems can be solved with just a little bit of extra spit and extra shine. And I think this goes back to his background as a community organizer, how he saw himself in the Senate for a few short years. And this is how he's approached Russia, China with the reset, you know, Burma, Cuba. It's that if we could just sit down at the table, then these issues would be able to be negotiated properly. And that's what he sees with Iran, is that everything is solvable. But the issue at the end of the day in this case is that that's not how it works in the Middle East. Compromise is often seen as weakness. And one person always gets the better of the other. I mean, it's kind of negotiating in a bazaar or in a market or something like that. So I think he really thinks in his mindset, and I think it's genuine, that he, if, you know, unlike the Bush administration, which, you know, axis of evil and wouldn't countenance sitting down with these guys, if he could just sit down with these guys, that they could solve a lot of problems in the region. And the nuclear file is the tip of the iceberg. The president has repeatedly said in numerous interviews the last couple of years that Iran should be a regional power, which I'm sure makes everybody else freak out a little bit. Yeah, Iran can take its rightful place. It's a prideful nation. It's almost as if he wants to build up Iran to be a counterbalancing power in the region.
Hmm. And we'll get into that and what the issues behind that are, whether they're good, positive, or negative, right after this quick break. I know Bob's ready to answer a question or ask one. We'll be right back in just a second. Sorry for the quick breaks there, Bob.
Yeah, it's okay, John.
We went a little long in the last segment. Yeah, we'll get back. It'll be okay.
Thank you.
Bob, you wanted to get into gas prices, right?
You know, there's something that's happened here that I just want to kind of take out a little bit, which is oil prices now 43, 44 bucks, possibly heading even lower. The impact on Iran and the Middle East in general has been nothing short of just, you know, catastrophic in some areas in terms of their ability to run their economies, needing much higher prices. So, you know, what would be the effect and why was this not taken into consideration in terms of moving this, you know, dialogue forward by keeping the pressure on lower oil prices? Would that not, and I know in addition to other factors, continue to have a major effect to our advantage in terms of influencing policy in that region, specifically with Iran?
You would have figured that the way the sanctions worked, and they were working in the sense that, you know, they were having an impact on the Iranian economy, and a big one, that something like this, you know, natural market force in terms of the major drop in the price of oil would only enhance that effect.
Right.
And it's wonderful because it wasn't even out of, doing of the U.S. government per se. I don't think the president saw it that way. I think the president, in some ways actually has been opposed to a lot of the fracking revolution that has happened in the United States. But I think the president didn't understand how that could have a accelerated impact. And that rather than thinking that time is on our side, that the longer that the Iranians wait, the longer the economy is bad, that the quicker they feel the need to concede on a number of issues, he thought it the other way, which is that in his mindset is that, well, I never wanted to impose these sanctions in the first place. Congress did so against my opposition, and so I need to figure out a way to negate them, because only when the Iranians are treated with respect and treated as equals will they come to the table and negotiate. So the president has appropriated after the fact the argument that is the sanctions that brought them to the table. But if you look at the record going back to 2008, the president has opposed the congressional sanctions at every turn and only accepted them after he realized he couldn't stop them.
He doesn't
oil will be the same.
He doesn't really understand Mid-Eastern mentality and culture. From a negotiating standpoint, they would be all over this if they were sitting on that side of the table. In fact, let's look at what the Saudis have recently tried to do. In many ways, it's an act of war. But it's an economic war that they purposely set out to, I don't want to say destroy, but to really mitigate our ability in terms of oil production in this country by driving many of the fringe fracking oil and gas companies out of business. So, you know, there's economic war and there's the physical confrontation. So it just floors me that this is not understood at such a high level.
Go ahead, Gabriel.
The Saudis had two targets for that when they did that last fall. One is, as you said, to the North American sort of fracking revolution, especially the United States. And it has had an impact in the sense that you had had a number of rigs, a number of wells go offline and new ones being dug. That's true. But their other target was Iran. I mean, the interim deal was only supposed to last a year. And so if you look at the expected deal, which was supposed to happen last November, that's about when the Saudis tried to change it. And they were concerned that the second a deal was signed and the sanctions are dropped, and as you said, all this Iranian oil and gas might start coming online, is that they needed to try and drop the price and kill the price because they had the reserves that could last them a much longer time than Iran did. So it remains to be seen when these sanctions come off of Iran how quickly their oil and gas market will rebound and will impact the prices. But I think the Saudis had an audience in Tehran they were focused on as well.
Gabriel, I want to give you something that you brought up. You said that the sanctions were working. And I want you to try to make the case for that, because the president himself said that they weren't working. A lot of people watched these sanctions for many years. And what did it do? It took money and supplies, and it basically hurt the lowest, the poorest people, and the people on top still were floating along. They were doing okay. Their policies hadn't changed much. They were still shipping missiles out for Hezbollah.
Hezbollah was getting funding.
Still funding terror
Hamas
around the world.
And various other groups. Yeah.
So how do you make the claim that it was actually working?
So we need to both define working and we need to define sanctions. By working, if the goal of the sanction was to physically stop the Iranian nuclear program, the sanctions have not worked. The Iranian nuclear program on all fronts have advanced. It's hard to say maybe they advanced less, more slowly than otherwise, but it has continued. The way the sanctions have worked is that they made the Iranians weak to the point that they felt like they actually needed to negotiate over the program in a way that they were not willing to do so before. And also when we talk about sanctions, again, yes, have sanctions impacted probably the entire country all from the top all the way down? That is true. But that's the nature of the beast. I mean, that was true in South Africa when the U.S. Imposed sanctions against the apartheid regime in South Africa. And in fact, a lot of anti-apartheid activists in South Africa welcomed those sanctions, knowing that that was the only way to get the regime to change its stripes. In Iran, again, it's not an ideal situation, but you know, we don't have any evidence that the sanctions have had a catastrophic impact on, let's say, health or living, you know, basic living standards to the point that you have a human catastrophe going on. But it has had an impact on the regime's ability to make decisions. Money is still zero sum. Yes, it is continuing to fund Hezbollah. Yes, it is continuing to fund Assad. But when they do that, the Iranian people themselves can see that this regime would rather spend money propping up non-Iranian entities rather than helping the people actually overcome the hardships. And that has a powerful argument in Iran as well.
We've got to go to our break, and when we come back, I want to ask a question specifically about, again, the sanctions, where they were working. So we'll go to our break. We'll see you shortly.
Give us a call at 721-1290, and you can come together on the radio as well. The phone number is 721-1290. We've got Gabriel Scheinman in the studio. And Bob, you teased us out with a question, and I have my big question. We'll ask as soon as Bob's done here.
The sanctions. Some of the sanctions were working, and where it was working were in the oil and gas and in their manufacturing industries, where getting parts were becoming extremely difficult. And if you want to talk about how quickly they could recapitalize and re-energize their energy industry, there is probably evidence that says it will not happen very quickly, as it is in disarray, and it will take some time. So when you're talking about where the sanctions did work, that's an area, from my perspective, that's very important in terms of future and current revenue. Your thoughts on that, Gabe?
That, I mean, absolutely. And the other thing is that sanctions don't work. It's not like, it's kind of like a spigot in a pipeline, right? You can turn off the spigot, but because the pipeline is really, really long, there's still a lot of water that's left in there, and it takes a long time for that to totally, flush out in that way. So when we imposed, and as a consequence, forced European companies to stop doing business there, it doesn't overnight that it has this impact. It takes months, sometimes a little, years to be able to get to that. So if you look at from when we imposed the oil sanctions in 2010, Iranian oil exports had dropped by about a half over the course of a couple years. If you look at denying Iran access to basically the international banking system and sanctioning the Iran central bank, all of a sudden, the number of financial transactions Iranian companies were allowed to do dropped dramatically, but over the course of a few months, if not a full year. So the whole point of sanctions is that as time goes on, the devastation is actually worse and worse. You can't just put them on, wait 3 months, see, well, the effect isn't so great, maybe it wasn't a good idea, and take them off. And that in and of itself is part of the problem with the snapback mechanism in the deal. If Iran, let's say, were to go for broke and go for the bomb, and the administration says that this deal keeps them a year away or a little less than a year away, there is no way that from the moment that they go for breakout to the moment that we recognize they're doing so, that we snap back the sanctions, that the sanctions will have actual impact for them to stop doing that. There is no precedent for that to happen, and that's a big problem.
All right. I want to ask my my big question of the day. I was hesitant to ask it, but you gave me confidence during the break. So here it is. Poll results show very regularly huge turnout for Democrats on behalf of Jewish, self-identifying Jewish people in the U.S. And I guess my question for you is this. First off, why? Why is there such support for Democrats by Jewish people in the United States? And second of all, do you think this issue will be a make-it-or-break-it sort of division for the Jewish people that live in the United States and the democratic regime? One of the reasons I ask this is because when I look at the country of Israel, well, of course, heavily Jewish, there are so many people that are outspoken against this Iranian deal. And only the heads of, and Chuck Schumer would identify with them, I think, here, only the heads of the Democratic Party and the Jewish people involved with that party are able to support it here. So I was wondering if you could take those two questions on for me.
Well, I can try. It's a perennial question, but and Chuck Schumer and there are some other Jewish members of Congress that are against the deal. But obviously, as we said before, there are a number that are for it as well. So it's kind of mixed on that front. But first of all, American Jews, just like most Americans, do not vote primarily on foreign policy issues. Far and away, they vote on economic, on social issues, and we see that poll after poll after poll. Foreign policy, in this case, let's say whether the president or a certain party is pro-Israel or not, really goes pretty far down on the list in terms of where they vote. They might disagree on a certain issue, but that disagreement does not necessarily rise high enough in the priority list to push them against. As to why historically Jews have kind of been with the Democratic Party, part of it goes back to, I think, sort of being immigrants and being coming to the country mostly destitute and poor over the course of a couple centuries, being relying on government services as a consequence and seeing that as a positive. FDR and the New Deal and the the creation and expansion of some of these services had a huge impact. So I think legacy-wise, that has stayed there as well. It's a nut that a lot of people have tried to crack. And even though the president in 2012 lost Jewish support compared to where he was in 2008, I mean, he lost support across the board compared to 2008. In almost every demographic, he had less support. That doesn't mean he still didn't win the vast majority of it. I think the breakdown is 70-30 for the president in terms of the American Jewish community. So it's a difficult question to answer.
So what about the second part of the question? Do you think this issue will further hinder that support?
Obviously it depends who the Democratic candidate is for 2016 and who the Republican candidate is as well. I think a lot of American Jews feel very uncomfortable with some of the overt religiosity expressed by a lot of the Republican candidates. They in many ways, being a minority in this country and historically having been a minority in most countries, they get a little queasy at the idea of sort of a Christian, and especially evangelical, even though evangelicals in the United States are some of the most pro-Israel community there is in the United States, but they get very uncomfortable about it because what that could mean for their own religious practice.
I was going to say, Jewish friends out there, please study the history on evangelicalism versus Catholics when it comes to the way that you've been treated in the past.
We got a phone call, but I got to ask Gabe, as a percentage of the population, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jewish population in this country is something like 1.3-1.4%.
Yeah, it depends how you count, but exactly, it's 5 to 6 million, so exactly a little under 2, something like that.
Right, so it's an extremely tiny population.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to go to line 3, grab Bruce. Bruce, thanks so much for calling in, sir.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Good talk here. It's my understanding that one of the provisions of this agreement with Iran is that the United States is supposed to provide security against sabotage and things like that. And I would be thinking that if Israel was facing an imminent threat, they would take matters into their own hands. So what would that do with the relations between Israel and America at that point?
Thanks for your call, Bruce.
You betcha.
It's a good question. And actually, in one of the congressional hearings that Secretary Kerry was testifying against, he got asked about this specifically in language read from the deal. And he didn't have a great answer. The deal says that the United States will help defend Iranian nuclear facilities from sabotage. And the only way to read that is that, first of all, that means that the United States has committed itself to stopping itself, ending its basically cyber attacks or covert attacks on the Iranian nuclear program, which we have done in the past, and technically helping Iran defend against whether it's Israeli or Iranian opposition or Gulf or other attacks on the Iranian program as well. So, the administration is trying to play that off of, we're just trying to help them do basic safety protocols, kind of best practices in a technocratic way. But the Iranians will absolutely read that and make a political argument saying that you promised to help us defend against threats to our program. I mean, it's built into the deal.
Now, Kerry, I watched this hearing. Kerry explicitly said they will do what they will do and we won't stop them. Along those lines, if Israel wants to take care of them, they're free to do so.
But it means is that in the past, and this has come out publicly, in the past the United States and Israel has cooperated on some of these programs.
Right, like the Stuxnet virus, for example.
Right, Stuxnet, the Olympic Games, a couple others. But what this means is that Israel is probably more likely not to cooperate with the United States in this because it fears that if it tells the United States or works with it to say, we're going to try and do this and try and do some sort of virus or something like that, the United States might warn the Iranians. We just don't know. The whole point of this agreement is that it is a political agreement. It's not a technocratic agreement. And so a political agreement can be lawyered to death. And the Iranians will use it, because they're great negotiators, will use it as an excuse to not fulfill some other part of the deal, because their reading of it, and it's a reasonable reading of it, says that the United States has committed itself to preventing any sort of sabotage attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities.
All right, we got to go to a break. Give us a call, 721-1290. Like Bruce, you can get your questions in. We only have a little bit of time left in the show. 721-1290 is the number. We'll be back in just a quick minute.
oobla-dee-oobla-da kind of sums up this whole negotiation discussion. Oobla-dee-oobla-da. Well, what the hey?
I saved for our last segment, hello, goodbye.
Okay.
So I don't know if I deserve any praise yet. Let me go ahead and grab Alan on line three. Alan, thanks for calling in, sir.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I've got a question concerning the development or the procurement of ICBMs by Iran in this treaty. What other purpose does an ICBM serve other than to be used to deliver a nuclear weapon? And so why is, if there's no nuclear weapon being allowed, they're obtaining ICBMs?
Well, and also I think a lot's in the name. ICBM, if you don't know, means Intercontinental Ballistic Missile.
Yes.
Gabriel, take this one on.
So I mean, I hope you're asking it rhetorically. I think you are, because there is no other purpose. I mean, we have no historical precedent of a country developing ICBMs without concurrently with a nuclear program. It doesn't exist. And ICBMs, by the way, not only are they to put nuclear warheads on top, but they're not aimed at local threats. They're not aimed at, from Iran's case, at the Persian Gulf, or even Israel. They already have the missiles can do that. They are aimed at Europe and the United States.
And the United States primarily.
Yep.
This just scares me to no end.
And yesterday, Secretary Kerry, in an interview he gave, someone asked, you know, if Iran, as part of this deal, I'm sure that's what you're referring to, we are ending the ballistic missile embargo after 8 years. And Secretary Kerry was asked, if Iran violates the embargo between now and then, is that cause for snapback? Will we be able to reimpose penalties? And Secretary Kerry said straight up, he said, no, that's not part of the nuclear deal. Wow. So we've accepted the Iranian argument that says these sanctions should be lifted as part of the nuclear deal, but at the same time we're saying there will be no punitive enforcement of the sanction because it's not part of the nuclear deal.
I hadn't heard that before. That's shocking.
You know, I really want to bring this administration with me to Vegas to play cards and use the House money with them because they are just not good poker players.
The House money is, what, $100 billion? We're holding
in leverage? $150 billion. So it's just, I'm really trying, as John said earlier, to get my head around the reasons why we should be in these negotiations. And I can see this happening. Republican president, Senate, Congress, after 2016, and this deal gets taken off the table again.
Well, I think there's a sense of do something disease where you feel like we've had the same policy for 7 years or more, 12 years, 20 years. We don't see a lot of change in the regime, a lot of change in behavior. So we got to do something different. Let's try something new. Let's be progressive about this.
And that's an argument the president has used often. Same thing with the Cuba.
Yeah, exactly.
We've had the policy for 50 years. It didn't work. Therefore, we try the opposite. But when assessing these things, that's not a rational way to think about it. Just because one thing didn't work, that doesn't mean the polar opposite does work. If you were in the medical field, you'd have your license suspended because, you know, if you prescribe one treatment that doesn't work and you say, well, what the hell, we'll try something else just because. Yeah. It doesn't work that way.
We've barred the doors. Zombies are still coming through the windows. The policy isn't working. Let's open the door.
Gabe, I'm very much focused on that with ISIS and Iraq, and really who's running Iraq right now. From my perspective, it's Iran. You've got their top general there. You've got their influence economically, politically. I have to think that this is a big part of why these negotiations have progressed this far, is that Obama clearly has said he wants to extract the U.S. from the Middle East as much as possible. So how much does this come into play from your perspective?
I think it comes into play quite a bit. I mean, like you said, I think we have to remember how he came into office. He came into office believing that, you know, he had, anti-Bush syndrome. Everything Bush did was bad, therefore he'll do the opposite. And the idea was that we were, his words, they use these words, over-invested in the Middle East, that too many of the problems in the Middle East were because of what we did, not because of what the Middle East is. And so if we pulled back and we would stop causing these problems, then the problems would go away. But the only way you can do that, and this is where there's some logic to the president's strategy, is that you need to empower local actors to be able to, you know, soak up the vacuum. Normally, you would empower your allies. You would support your allies, whether it's Israel or Turkey or Saudi Arabia, more so, give them more arms, more support to sort of secure the region. The president believes in empowering our adversaries, being that if they can be brought into the tent and their behavior can be moderated, they can actually be a force for stability.
I wanted to ask you a question about the idea of maybe a bipolar sort of situation. I think that one of the impulses behind allowing Iran to build up is a counterbalance to some of the radical groups, for example, ISIS in the region, and perhaps a counterbalance to some of the Saudi groups in that region as well. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that's part of a motivation to try to make a bipolar system down there?
He's talked about it. The president has talked about it. And he says that, you know, in the long run, it would be good to have a Shiite-Sunni balance. And what that means in this case, literally, is empowering Iran to be seen as an equal compared to our traditional Sunni allies. And that, I mean, of all the comments that the president can make, that is what sets the hair on fire of some of these Arab allies that we have.
Remember
they're,
when we
literally saying empowering their enemies.
We had a balance. Remember when Iran and Iraq were fighting each other?
Yeah. But that, it also goes back, it goes back even, right, and that caused a million deaths. But it goes back even before that in the sense that the reason we were allied with the Shah of Iran for three decades, basically, from World War II onwards, is because Iran was such a big country. I mean, it's an 80 million or 90 million population. It's called the Persian Gulf for a reason. And when we lost the Shah, we lost one pillar of our stool in the Middle East to keep it balanced. And every administration, whether it's Reagan as part of Iran-Contra, whether it was Clinton in terms of Madeleine Albright, apologized to Iran for past American behavior, and Obama, they've tried to reach out to Iran thinking that if only we could get them to change their stripes just a little bit, then we can go back to the old ways of doing things. And it's a fundamental misreading of the ideology of this regime and a fundamental misreading of the power dynamics at play inside Iran. There's when the guys have the guns, they don't cede power so easily. I mean, it just doesn't happen that way.
All right, we have time for maybe one more caller, one more question before we're out of time for the show. I have a quick one-minute break. We'll be right back. You'll hear hello, goodbye, and we'll be back into our final segment. Be back in just a quick minute. All right, we're back on the Talkback Show, saying goodbye to Gabriel Scheinman. We have one last segment with him. If you want to call and get a question in, 721-1290 is the number. Now, Bob, you wanted to transition into the final segment. You had a question for Gabriel.
Yeah, before we lose him first, yes, Gabe, we will get you the podcast. My assistant is back from vacation tomorrow, so put that on the list. But how are the allies of ours in the Middle East viewing this discussion, and what are some of the behaviors that you see starting to happen based on their concerns about where they think this may be going?
I mean, they are, put it crudely, I think that they're peeing in their pants, to be perfectly honest. They are used to the United States leading the charge against countering Iran, and now you see the United States partnering with Iran to deal with a lot of regional issues. So some of the things they see when they do that is that they get nervous, and they start acting in ways that are not necessarily most thought through. The most obvious example of this is the Saudi-led war in Yemen over the past 4 months. The Saudis have basically invested a lot of both money, troops, air power, another four or five countries into this war in Yemen to try and reverse an Iranian-backed takeover of the government, and so far they don't have a lot to show for it. You could have them bogged down in there for a long time. You could see whether it's Israel or other countries acting a little bit more nervously the next time they receive a rocket from Hezbollah that come down. It's not going to be seen as a one-off thing. It's going to be seen as, is this the beginning of an Iranian-backed initiative? Do we need to deal with this and escalate in such a way now before Hezbollah becomes more empowered as a result of the deal down the road? I think that the allies will act in such a way because it's not just the deal itself, it's that they no longer trust the United States to deal with the consequences of it.
Okay,
and as a consequence, they will take more initiative.
This is a question one of my my callers here in Missoula asked. It's a question I want to ask you because it's a question on the minds of lots of Democrats and Republicans, I think. So if not this deal, then what? What's your answer? What's your solution?
I mean, it's a tough question, and I think that's one of the few honest questions the president asks in this debate. He answers it himself in a dishonest way, but the question is honest. And the idea is that we've put ourselves back into a hole, but there's no reason that we couldn't maintain the sanctions architecture that exists. In fact, turn the dial up even more so. But most importantly is we need to reestablish a credible military threat to the Iranian program. That doesn't mean we need to use it. I mean, we're a far cry from that. But we need to reestablish the credible military threat. When we cut our defense spending by 20% over the last 6 years, when we are sequestering ourselves in such a way that we can no longer project out how we're going to set up our forces, when we withdraw from the Middle East, when we try and contain the rhetoric and the decisions of our allies to be more aggressive, the Iranians don't take it seriously. I don't think there's a single Iranian leader that, where they're sitting right now, honestly thinks that no matter what, that the president will actually rain down missiles on them if push comes to shove. And once you take that away, the Iranians say it doesn't matter what they do because we know they won't go to that. So you need to reestablish that in a credible way.
Let me ask you this. This is probably the way I would frame the maybe a possible solution, something that that you could vote for. All right. What if it went back to the table? Same sanctions negotiation, right? And instead of this one, there's no, absolutely no ICBM development allowed by Iran. If they break it, sanctions come back into place or a military threat of some sort. What if the $150 billion or so that the U.S. is going to free up from the frozen banking, instead of being directly back to the current administration, is funneled through either human aid or some way that it hits the streets and not the the leadership directly? What if the rules were more strict and basically absolutely no military nuclear development use? Would that be something you could support?
Unfortunately not, because that is the tail that wagged the dog. The two biggest problems with the nuclear deal aren't all the other kind of Christmas tree lights on it. It's that the core issues. One is that it allows Iran does not have to dismantle a single centrifuge. And in fact, it will, even with this deal in effect, be having more centrifuge enriching uranium at the end of the Obama administration than it did on day one of the Obama administration. That's number one. And the second issue is that the sunsets in the deal allow Iran to keep to the deal, and after 10, 11, or 12 years, all restrictions on its nuclear program are gone, and the sanctions are also permanently gone as well. So Iran can abide by the deal and yet still get all that it wants. And those are the two biggest core issues with the deal, as opposed to everything else that comes with it. And until you either change that to dismantle a significant portion of the Iranian nuclear program, and more importantly, extend the deal to 20, 25, or 30 years, the rest of it is whipped cream or whatever you want to call it.
Thanks, Gabriel. Thanks so much for joining us. That's Gabriel Scheinman from the Jewish Policy Center. He's the director there. We are almost out of time. 10 seconds left. I wanted to welcome everybody to our show tomorrow. We're going to be speaking with World 2 Council members. All three of the ones we haven't talked to yet will be on the show.
Gabe, I'll be reaching out to you.